Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we will be speaking to Rick Carver and Stacy Pearl about the new book, A Year or So in the Life of New Mexico, An Uncensored Look at Life in the Land of Enchantment. And we'll be speaking with Nicholas Kralev about his new book, Decoding Air Travel, A Guide to Saving on Airfare and Flying in Luxury. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Beth Kennedy Jones and Matt McCollum. They are cast members of the new play God's Fool, presented by the Arden Players, and there is an open dress rehearsal prior to the New York and Edinburgh Festival runs of the play. It's tomorrow, the 8th of July, Friday at 7:30 at Warehouse 21. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Hi there.
So this is the same, kind of the same St. Francis play that we had
In the fall, it was workshopped here in Santa Fe and also in Albuquerque. At that time, it was called Lion and the Lamb, the revolutionary
right.
spirit of St. Francis of Assisi. As we know, this is our patron saint,
St. Francis of Santa Fe.
And there have been many script revisions. We really listened to what people that came to see the workshop, what they said about it, took it in lots of different directions. We have now this play. And we've had some cast changes, which is why Matthew came into it.
Yeah, you just graduated from Yale College. You're about to go to Yale Drama School.
Mm-hmm.
And you just come to Santa Fe to rehearse as St. Francis?
Yeah, it just kind of fell into my lap. It was this crazy kind of friend of a friend scenario that ended up getting me introduced to our director, Deborah Dennison. And she had me put myself on tape for the role a couple times. And for reasons, I think, against my better judgment or hers, I ended up getting the part, and so she was kind enough to fly me out here
to
work with the cast.
About it now.
Well, I hope so. You know, if I screw up, things go terribly wrong in this play.
No. Deborah actually went to New York and did casting in New York and in England because we're going to be in Scotland, so we were trying to find out, you know, which actors out there and actresses were right for the parts. And it just worked out to have Matthew come out here and work with certain cast members here. And then we're going to do this open dress on Friday night. And then Matthew's going to go back on Saturday morning. But we will head to New York at the end of the month, around the 21st, 22nd, depending on when people's flights are. And we have five performances in New York City at 59 East 59th Street Theater. This is a great theater. It's right around the corner from, like, the Plaza or Big Apple Store on Fifth Avenue.
Yeah, that's easy to remember. 59 East 59th.
59 East 59th. It was started by this woman that started. There were actually three theaters there. And she just got the Drama Desk Award for Best Off-Broadway House. So it's a beautiful location. And she does something called East to Edinburgh. So that plays that are going to Edinburgh have the opportunity to perform there. So we'll be there for five performances.
Very interesting. Along with a lot of other American performances going to
Edinburgh. Exactly. Yeah, and then August 1st, we all fly to Scotland.
Now, that's a very big deal. I mean, the Edinburgh Festival is, that's no joke.
It's huge. I mean, the Edinburgh Festival is 3 weeks and has an audience of 1 million people over those 3 weeks that come in from all around the world. It is an international, it is the largest international arts festival in the world. It was started right after World War II because the British Isles was aware they wanted to build culture again. So they started this festival, and it's just grown and grown and grown. And it's the people that come there come because they are passionate about the arts. And Deborah Dennison, who wrote this play, and she's written for TV, she's written for film. This is her first play. Really wanted to see it on a larger stage.
And she's done a lot of stage acting and directing.
Yes, exactly. And she's had the Arden Players for a while. So it is a big thing. We're all excited about it. And Deborah is the producer of it, although I'm co-producing with her. She's taken the lion's share of the project. And we're excited. I mean, we're excited about going there, of course. And, you know, Alex Baldwin has a piece there, and John Malkovich has a piece in Scotland this summer, so it'll be fun to see that. Deborah, also with the Arden Players, she's building a Shakespeare Festival here in Santa Fe to present classical plays and new works. And we have been working with the governor's office for tourism.
And here in New Mexico.
Here in New Mexico, and then the Santa Fe Convention and Visitors Bureau, because we really want to look at this audience, both in, but specifically in Scotland, giving the information, as much information as we can, about Santa Fe and New Mexico. And that, and Santa Fe is the second largest art capital in America,
yeah.
Second only to New York. And so we're also working with them to figure out ways to present this play as coming from Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Right.
Which is a big piece of it, too.
Well, yeah, and considering our patron saint is St. Francis.
Exactly.
Shouldn't be that hard to sell.
And one of the things that she really... there's a lot of focus in the play on many different issues, but that St. Francis of Assisi was an environmentalist and a feminist long before those words were coined. Advocate of all animals. You know,
well,
his approach.
Yeah, let's talk about his character. I mean, here you are, Matt, playing St. Francis.
Mm-hmm.
What's he like? I mean, guy who talks to animals, but he's not exactly a silly little wimpy guy either.
No, I think that the title of the play really says it all, because Francis liked to refer to himself as God's fool. And I think that really comes through in the character. He takes a great joy in the work he does, which is not at all easy work. This, you know, as the story goes, he gave up a fairly comfortable life to live in some of the most absolute poverty that anyone can imagine, and in that most likely contracted a multitude of diseases from working with and trying to heal all sorts of diseases from all walks of life from all parts of Europe, which at the time was probably not the smartest idea if you wanted to stay healthy.
And his parents and family couldn't believe it.
Oh, they completely disowned him for the most part. His father just could not believe what he was doing. And I think in some ways at the time, Francis probably was unsure of where it was going to go. This play really does chronicle the life of Francis from his decision to really give up his former dreams of becoming a troubadour in the night and living that life, and kind of goes through to the end of his life when he sees what his brothers minor, what they have kind of become, and what the church is going to be doing with his organization and with his rule. So I'd say that the things that I really love about Francis are his sense of humor. He is constantly self-deprecating, which is incredibly refreshing compared to the kind of political hoity-toityness of the rest of the Catholic Church at the time. He really kind of stood out by being this very open, honest, not at all holier-than-thou kind of a guy. And I'm not quite sure he recognized just how much that would be considered important, and just how much of a change that ended up being in that world. You know, but he also does have a lot of strength. He's very, very serious about what he chooses to do, in spite of the fact that he also has a sense of humor about it. But he absolutely believes with all his heart in the work that he and his brothers are doing.
And what is that work?
It is a life dedicated to poverty and service, basically. Their biggest... I guess their biggest task is to go and help the sick and to heal those that they can. A lot of what Francis does in this place, he goes to different warrior camps during the Crusades, and he spends time healing the soldiers on both sides of the conflict. In addition to that, they vowed to live a life of absolute poverty. They took literally nothing with them, and they begged for all of their food. And if no one would give them anything, they took nothing. They were very, very strict about that absolute poverty. So those are the two biggest parts of his doctrine. They were travelers. They took, again, literally nothing with them. He quotes, I think, Matthew, when he says, neither staff nor haversack nor food. They wear rough habits, rope and sandals when they are absolutely necessary, and they wander the entire European countryside in all kinds of weather and heal whoever they can help. Francis also took a great pride in rebuilding certain churches that had kind of come under disrepair and that the Catholic Church had forgotten about, most notably the one that is in this play, which is San Damiano in Assisi, which is the first one that he actually rebuilt by begging for the stones himself.
Right, right. And visitors to Assisi have been to that church. Mm-hmm. It's still there.
Yeah.
Beth Kennedy Jones, tell us about your role in this play.
I get to play the mother of a saint, which is pretty cool. I'm Pico, and my relationship with my husband, Pietro, who's played by Paul Walski, who's not only a Santa Fe actor, but also a very well-known neurologist here in Santa Fe.
Right.
He's a great guy to work with and has been with the play since the beginning. It's the relationship of this father, mother, and their son when he goes through his change of heart about what he wants to explore in his life. Pico was very encouraging of her son's spirituality. And so there's reason to believe that she was an important part in this. But then because my husband and Pietro basically disowns Francis, at that point her relationship stops with him. So all during his years really having his cause and becoming a priest and becoming St. Francis that we know, she was not a part of that experience. And so there's another scene then with Claire, who started the Claires, which is the nuns, sister.
The sort of the female counterparts,
exactly,
of St. Francis's,
yeah,
movement.
So there's a scene also with Claire later on, just shortly before Francis actually dies. So it's
and
not.
And she's played by the wonderful Jeannie Michaela, who's back,
right,
from New York.
Exactly. And who had been at Yale too, so we've,
right,
got a lot of Yale representatives here. So it's Pika's actually a small part, but I think a valuable part.
Yeah.
And then it's been great to work with Deborah as well in producing this play and taking it to Scotland, New York.
Deborah, who unfortunately can't be with us because she's taking care of an ailing dog.
Yeah.
So our love and condolences to her about her poor little dog. What is it like to see, I mean, I think it's interesting, and one of the reasons I wanted to get you guys on the air again to talk about this play, and we did talk about it last fall, is because it's interesting for you as an actor, Beth, who's been through the whole thing, and for us as audience members who might have seen the first round, to watch a play evolve, mm-hmm, to watch it go through rewrites, to watch it get better.
Yeah, it's such an important part of the process, and because of financial constraints, it's not always something that can be done, but a play to get feedback. You know, one of the reasons why we're doing this open dress on Friday night, which I think we've got pretty much a full house, which is great, is to get that feedback, because you don't ever know, and the actors in a way don't really know, and it's really hard for a playwright to know if the message is getting across and getting across not only in an understandable format but also an entertaining format. So the process is extremely important, but it's also historically accurate. This is enormous research that Deborah's done and taken on, and so therefore we really are getting maybe a very different vision of St. Francis, of what his life was about, which was not wrapped up in the hierarchy of the church, but he certainly was very respectful to the church.
Now, when you go to Edinburgh, there you are with 4 gazillion other plays, and uh-huh, you know, everybody's there. How do you get people to come to your play?
Well, there's a huge process that the theater in Scotland is Nidri. It's right across from the box office, which helps. And I'd gone to the first meeting. The Fringe has a meeting in New York in January, and I was at that meeting. And they say the actors literally go out in the streets, often dressed in costume. I mean, it's a.
Are you going to walk around as St. Francis?
Well, I haven't been given my orders yet, but I don't think I can rule that out. I've been to Edinburgh, and I can absolutely attest to that. I mean, it is just kind of this barrage of both people in costume and in street clothes shoving flyers and postcards at you, and of course we're all watching each other. So the second that you see someone take a postcard from someone else, they are completely bum rushed by about 30 other shows. It's chaos. It's a wonderful kind of chaos, though.
And people doing scenes on the street.
Yeah.
You do a scene from your show, and then you pass out flyers. Jeannie and I were talking about that today, because in our scene, I start out by saying, "Are you Sister Claire?" So it's like if we were both, you know, meeting on a street, and then you start out with that, and then see how people get engrossed in it. I mean, there's the fun of it. besides for the, just the theater of it. And, you know, there's theater, but there's also music and there's opera and there is, you know, stand-up comedy, dance, a lot of children's theater. I mean, there's just a barrage.
And speaking of tourism, people coming from all over the world to see and hear all this.
And what often they're coming, there are people that are coming as an audience, and there's also people that are coming to find plays to bring to their respective countries.
So that's a possibility and a hope for probably you and everybody else who goes.
Sure, of course.
The play is called God's Fool, and the dress rehearsal is tomorrow, Friday night at 7:30 at Warehouse 21. Now, can people still go, or is it full? Or
well, we're looking at like it's going to be a really full house.
Yeah.
But we're not going to discourage anybody from coming.
Can you get tickets in advance?
No, we're not doing any tickets.
All right. So show up, ladies and gentlemen. I'm assuming it's free.
It is. It's free. And although people are welcome to bring their checkbooks.
And make a donation.
And make a donation, because this is really being produced by Deborah Dennison, which means airfares and hotel rooms.
Right.
And it's a huge deal.
Great. Well, Matt McCollum, St. Francis of Assisi, Beth Kennedy Jones, are cast members of God's Fool, presented by the Arden Players. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us, Mayor Charlotte.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned. I'm delighted now to welcome to the show Rick Carver. He's a photojournalist and executive producer of the book A Year or So in the Life of New Mexico, an uncensored look at life in the land of enchantment. And Stacy Pearl, who is one of our KSFR producers and also the writer for almost all the essays in this book. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's nice to
be
here.
So this book is conceived of as, among other things, a benefit for Esperanza Shelter. How did that come about?
About 10 years ago, I retired myself as a photojournalist, and I hung up my cameras. About 4 years ago, I got the bug to take up photography again, and it was about that time that I hatched this idea of producing a book. And after a lot of soul-searching, we came upon an idea of doing a book about life in New Mexico and benefiting Esperanza in particular.
And so the photographs, was that where you started? You solicited photographs from basically anybody who wanted to take them?
I went around and did a lot of recruiting. I found a lot of photographers. The idea initially was anybody with a camera could take part in this project and submit photographs for possible publication in the book. And we ended up with 53 photographers.
And one of the criteria was they did not have to be professional photographers. We just wanted a commitment from them to photograph for an entire year, not just to have one photo in their repertoire, but to really commit to what their view of New Mexico looked like and then share that with us.
What an interesting project for somebody, whether they be professional or amateur, to engage in, is say, okay, I'm going to take pictures of my view of New Mexico.
It's a great goal, and I think a lot of people got really excited about the idea that just with their simple tools, with their, you know, perhaps instant digital camera, they could have a published photograph in a book that would stand for something they could be proud of.
And so you had to recruit, basically, if this is going to be a book about New Mexico, people from all over the state.
That's exactly it.
How'd you do that?
I went to a number of the colleges that still have photography programs, like Santa Fe Community College and New Mexico State down in Las Cruces. And that was the initial way of recruiting photographers or students in photography who would be their first opportunity to get published.
And then we also went to photo stores, and we also went through professional photographers and asked them to connect to friends. And we used sort of the friends network. We used social media to connect to people, say, are you interested in New Mexico? You're taking photos? We want to see them.
And so you must have then gotten 5 gobzillion photos.
It was somewhere around 5,100.
Oh, okay. And so then you had to go through a very rigorous process of editing.
That was, for me, it was one of the hardest things to do, is to go through all those images and select what ended up being about 400 pictures for the book.
Now, did you start with the various categories in the book? For example, you've got nature and heroes and all sorts of things, treasures and helping hands and military and environment and rodeo. Did you start with those categories, or did the photographs suggest them?
From the beginning, the book, the whole project evolved as an ongoing, just an ongoing thing that just kept growing and growing. We wanted to publish a book that described the beauty of New Mexico, plus some of the issues involving all of us who live here, including DWI and homelessness, et cetera, et cetera.
So we did have a basic list of categories that we expected to cover. However, the photos developed in different ways. So, for instance, I don't think we were aware at the beginning what an important part the rodeo would play. We were unaware what a big part of New Mexican life that was on both professional, college, and young adult level.
And so, on Indian reservations. And
right. You know, for a lot of people, I mean, that was one of my more fascinating interviews because we went to the rodeo and I interviewed a lot of the bull riders, and I hadn't realized that for them, this was their only option. A lot of these guys grew up on the ranch. Their parents had done well. They had no other job skills, and this was like the big golden ring. There are guys on that rodeo tour who've earned $1 million. And so it was really fascinating to see that whole part of life, which I frankly didn't even know existed in New Mexico. So we covered that quite extensively.
Yes, and one of the beauties of this book is discovering all these photographs by all these different people. And, I mean, you've put an uncensored look. What did you mean by that?
When I recruited for this book, I said that there would be absolutely no censorship. No subject matter would go untouched. Anything was on the table.
So it didn't have to all just be chilies and pueblos.
Not at all.
I think we've got that covered. I think there are many books that have been
published. You think there's a few other books about those
things? I think
there's
one or two that cover the beautiful hand-painted mailboxes on Canyon Road, and they're lovely. But we felt like life here is, I mean, true diversity is so much more complex, and the problems are so intense in this state. It's a very difficult place for a lot of people to make a living, and it has so many cross-cultural references. And we thought no one ever talks about that, you know.
Except on this show, we
talk
about
you do, of course. But I mean, in terms of like books about New Mexico,
yeah.
You know, the hunger issue, the DWI issue, are things that affect more people's lives than the gorgeous sunset.
Right.
So we felt that was really our niche that we could, and there were a lot of people who were very concerned about those things and wanted to photograph them.
So one of the things that you have, well, let's start with the very beginning. It's sort of funny that it starts with a kind of archaeology, the ruins of New Mexico, but a lot of the ruins are 20th century ruins, broken gas pumps and buildings that are completely abandoned and eaten out by weather, but they're still there and you can just barely make out what they are.
We're really blessed in New Mexico having a lot of really good photographers, and every time we go out looking for things to photograph, we find those beat up mailboxes and the rundown gas stations, and New Mexico's got a lot of that, and they're a good fodder for a good photographer.
They're so poetic. those moments on the road are so poetic.
They really are.
Yeah.
And you also have a section on big coal and basically the damage that the pollution is doing to our state and particularly people on the Navajo Reservation.
Yes, and we were fortunate enough to get a very accomplished writer, Mary Beeth, to write that piece of text. She is an environmental expert and a photographer and an artist. And she was very interested in covering that for us, and so she wrote that essay.
We're talking to Rick Carver and Stacy Pearl about the book A Year or So in the Life of New Mexico, an uncensored look at life in the Land of Enchantment. Now, this actually took more than a year to put together, I take it.
Probably 2.5 years, I think.
It's because Rick can't say no to anyone.
Yeah, I can't say no.
All along the process, when we kept having a cutoff date, someone else would say, oh, I didn't know about this. I'd love to participate. And Rick would say, of course, start taking pictures.
Right.
So that's sort of the nature of our time frame.
Well, and it worked out so well because the pictures are, I've never quite seen a book like this. They're spectacular and they're dramatic, but they're expressive in a lot of different ways. And there they are all next to each other. And each one has, I mean, they're, some photographers have more than one photograph in there, but there's a really wide variety of people.
And one of Rick's goals was that pretty much everybody who submitted photos has at least one photo in the book.
Right.
So nobody was left out. Because it's a lot of work for somebody to take photos for us. And they did this out of kindness. Nobody was paid for anything. And so we felt the least we could do is at least include one. But some of the photographers submitted hundreds of photographs, one photographer. And so we included as many as we thought were excellent, and there were quite a few.
There's a place called the Wildlife West Nature Park.
In Edgewood. Owned by Roger Ehrlich.
Yeah.
A very nice gentleman. And all the wildlife over there are rescued wildlife from somewhere around New Mexico.
It's a beautiful spread about him and about these animals in the book, and gives you a sense of yet another person who is giving their life in this way that is understated and important and beautiful all at the same time.
He was an amazing man. It was so great to interview him. He was so kind. He was so gentle. And his only concern was helping the animals and educating youth into our environment. He gets no funding. It's all volunteer work. And he does it out of love. I mean, he's an amazing man.
Now, you also look at Esperanza Shelter, food banks, Joy Junction, all sorts of institutions that are helping people. Maybe you could talk about some of those a little bit, because Esperanza is the recipient of whatever benefit comes from this book.
They will get all the benefit from this book. Roadrunner in particular, Joy Junction also. I had no idea when I started this that I would run into, I would see firsthand a lot of the problems. I mean, my goodness, Roadrunner is a huge warehouse in Albuquerque, and they feed thousands every month. And all these people are pretty much destitute. They need food. And if it wasn't for people like Roadrunner, they'd starve.
And Roadrunner is a place also where I spent a little bit of time, and I interviewed some of the people who work there and the people that run it. And they had just purchased this space that was the size of a football field, and they already saw that they were going to run out of space because every single day their needs were increasing. And not only do they have a food bank where they distribute food, they have five or six different programs, one particular which I thought was fascinating, where they have a backpack program, because I realized a lot of the children, when they're not in school on the weekends, have no meals. So they send them home with backpacks full of food, which they pack very carefully with things that aren't sharp, with shelf-stable food, so the kids could have things to eat on the weekends, and they return the backpack on Monday, and on Friday they get it again to go home. These are programs I don't think a lot of people know about.
Yeah, exactly. And so well-conceived to actually address the problem at hand.
Yes, and most of that is volunteer help. And something I didn't know about them was that they purchase something like I think it was 70 or 80% of the food they have to buy. They get donations, but the needs are so enormous that they go out and purchase their foods. And they have a walk-in that's the size of, like, most people's homes, full of, you know, perishables and non-perishables, and they repack things. The amount of labor involved in getting food out to the people is enormous. And I should also mention that they welcome people to come visit them and tour the facility.
Now, there's also, speaking of nutrition, a picture that really struck me, which is a booth where they're selling deep-fried Twinkies.
Unfortunately, that is a part of the New Mexican diet.
Deep-fried Twinkies, deep-fried Oreos, deep-fried candy bars, and deep-fried cheesecake are all available. Where is this thing?
Yum.
State fairs?
That was a picture taken from the state fair a couple of years ago.
Amazing.
It was amazing.
You can't get that at the food bank, nor should you.
No.
No.
But there's some other things, too. I mean, when you look through this book, it's almost like a state of so many subcultures that really don't interact with each other. I mean,
it's
a lot of worlds. Like, you've got the Rainbow Gathering, you've got roller derby, you've got the military.
And I think that's one of the things that I think a lot of people who are involved in one of those groups are not aware of the others. I mean, for instance, the roller derby. Roller derby is the fastest growing female sport in America. It's the only full contact sport. And New Mexico has a great roller derby league, and it's an absolutely fantastic way to go spend your time. There's rules. It's not just a free-for-all. It's not like the bad movies. It's an actual sport, and it's so much fun, and there is a whole culture that goes with it.
I know. We've talked about it on this show. I didn't even know it was there until some of the very nice and amazingly athletic ladies came.
Yes. Don't mess with them.
Do not mess with roller derby ladies.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen. And then, of course, we can't forget the Rainbow Gathering, which is not always, of course, in New Mexico.
Right. Rick, you enjoyed that, didn't you?
That was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to take some really unique pictures. And I think you would agree that there are three in there that are pretty unique.
Psychedelia lives on, ladies and gentlemen. The book is a year or so in the life of New Mexico. Rick Carver and Stacey Pearl with us here on the Radio Cafe. Some of the other things, aliens in Roswell. One sort of mysterious photo that looks like an alien autopsy.
Well, there's lots of rumors floating around about those aliens, and all I can say is if you look at the pictures, a picture's worth a thousand words. You can believe it or not.
Well, I need the thousand words.
Rick loves the aliens, and he loves talk up the whole Roswell culture, and it is a great place to take photographs, and the whole town is just so alien crazy. They have developed an entire tourist agenda based on these aliens, and I think it's hysterical. And people from all over the world, my relatives in England said, have you ever been to Roswell?
Right.
So I think, you know, it's sort of, to me, funny. A lot of people, it's quite serious. You know, when you have, you know, and, you know, you have all the conspiracy theorists who just love to go there and talk about, you know, what is it called, 51?
Area 51.
Area 51.
Which is actually in Nevada.
Right.
About which there's a new book.
Is there?
Yes. I just saw an interview about it on television the other night, and the theory about what, well, we won't get into that right now, ladies and gentlemen.
But once again, an important part of life in New Mexico is the whole alien agenda.
Right. The alien agenda. Now, there's quite a bit of Native American photographs in here, too, and you have other people writing essays?
Yes. One of my friends, Elena Ortiz, who is married to a Native American and spends a lot of time on the reservation, and her children interact and with all the other Native Americans, and they do the powwow. And she's very knowledgeable, and I thought, well, I should let her write those pieces because she knows what she's talking about. She's an excellent writer, and she was kind enough to write us some piece. And Rick got some really excellent access to some of the powwows and the rodeo, and spent a good deal of time taking those photos, and it was a really good experience, wasn't it?
It was a special occurrence. One thing occurred to me at the beginning of the project was that having Native American pictures in the book were very important to me. And the Navajo Nation is really a very large area, including New Mexico.
Right.
So it counted to me to have that included as part of life in New Mexico. That was very special.
Now, you took some of the photographs in the book.
Yes. I took a lot. There were a lot of things that if I hadn't have made arrangements to take the pictures myself, they would not have been included in the book. The section on the USS New Mexico, that would not have occurred had I not gone made arrangements to go to Norfolk, Virginia for the commissioning.
So the book is called A Year or So in the Life of New Mexico, An Uncensored Look at Life in the Land of Enchantment. Rick Carver is the executive producer. I always think of that as a film thing, but I guess that's really what the job was for this book. And Stacey Pearl wrote almost all the essays in the book. It's available at our local bookstores here in New Mexico.
It will also be available directly through the Esperanza website, and that's probably the best place to get it because the funds go right to them. It is also for sale on our website, which is www.ayearorsonm.com. It could be purchased directly through our website, and we will have it in the local bookstores as soon as it is out to be launched very shortly.
And the Esperanza Shelter's website is esperanzashelter.org. Thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Nicholas Kralev. He is former Financial Times and Washington Times correspondent, and his new book is called Decoding Air Travel, A Guide to Saving on Airfare and Flying in Luxury. And he will be speaking today at 5 o'clock at the Travel Bug Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good to be here.
So you have, as a journalist who traveled all over the world for many, many years, extensive experience in basically getting low airfares. What are some of the secrets that you put in your book that we wouldn't know if we were just trying to get an airfare on, like, Expedia or one of those sites?
Oh, okay. So you want me to give away secrets? Okay, I'll give away a couple.
Well, that's what your book is.
let me just say that over the years, I've been so frustrated with the automated systems that all the airlines and all those websites you mentioned, like the Expedias, the Orbitzes, and the Travelocities of the world, because they all use, you know, the same or almost the same automated systems, and they give us fares that they tell us are the lowest, but actually they're not. So what I decided to do was to actually learn the system in such detail so I can construct my own airfare. And so that's the first secret, is don't rely on these automated websites, but get access to what I call raw airline data as it's published by the airlines. There are two websites currently that can give you that access. One is called Expert Flyer. The other one is KVS Tool, KVS Kilo Victor Sam. Now they're not free. They have an annual subscription or monthly subscription, but that's what I go to actually see, for example, that American Airlines has published a fare. I'm just making this up to make the point, but of Albuquerque to Dallas, for example, $79 each way. Now, if American Airlines has published that fare, then I should be able to get it. And if I'm not getting it from all those websites, then, I should take matters in my own hands and construct the fare and get it what I should deserve, or what I deserve to get.
Now, is this accessible or even possible to people who don't fly frequently? Let's say you take one vacation a year. Is it still worthwhile to do this or even possible?
Well, it is possible. It's just worthwhile, if you're going overseas, if you have a family of three or four or five members, then it is worth it. However, if you're just by yourself or with your spouse and you do this once a year and it's to the Caribbean or somewhere closer, then you probably will be better off using websites like Kayak or another website called ITA Software. ITA Software is actually a very good site, which is not a booking site, but at least it will point you to the right direction and will give you enough information for your approximate travel dates to send you to the right airline. And then what I would do is just go straight to that airline's website and book directly with the airline, because booking through all these third-party sites can be very tricky and very risky.
How are the airlines doing right now financially?
Well, they're doing a little worse than they predicted, but still much better than last year or the year before, largely because of those billions of dollars of so-called ancillary revenues, which, of course, come from the baggage fees and all sorts of fees they've imposed in the past couple of years. So they aren't doing terribly, terribly badly. They're doing okay.
How do they feel? Have you spoken to anybody in the airlines about the work you're doing? And do they want travelers to know how much money they can save in the ways that you're talking about?
Well, the book just came out last week. I have mentioned that I was writing the book to a couple of airlines. I haven't actually sent them the book or shown it to them. It's funny you're asking, because I was trying to see yesterday whether the book's website, which is decodingairtravel.com, whether it had any visits from the airlines. I don't see yet any visits from the airlines. My personal website, where I write a column, nicholaskralev.com, gets a lot of visits from airlines, but the book hasn't yet. I'm sure as the book gets purchased by more and more people and the word gets out, they will figuring out whether I'm trying to harm them. It's true, I am teaching people how to get lower fares, how to save a lot of money. At the same time, though, if you look longer term, my philosophy is the more affordable travel becomes for people, the more comfortable it becomes, because not only do I teach how to save money, but how to fly business and first class for the price of coach, more people will fly. And so in the long run, I think the airlines will have an interest in having customers who are loyal, who fly more than once or twice a year, and perhaps who come to the same airline or at least the same alliance in the future, and not being just a one-time customer.
Now, this thing about flying first class or coach, first class for coach fares or business class, is that something that necessarily goes with a frequent flyer program?
It does, and many people ask him, well, is it worth trying to achieve elite status? The answer is yes, it is worth it, because imagine you're going on vacation with your four-member family and your baggage fees are waived. This is $25 per person for one bag, so you're waiving $100 each way, so you'll be waiving $200 for that one trip. And many people think it's difficult to achieve elite status. And actually, it's not that difficult. You should sort of broaden your horizons when you think of elite status, because you don't have to be a member of the program of an American carrier. All these alliances globally that there are now, the Star Alliance, the One World, Sky Team, they allow you to, for example, qualify by flying on United or Continental to become a member of another Star Alliance frequent flyer program. And there are many foreign-based programs that require many, many fewer miles to qualify for elite status than the American carriers do. And so by flying on United, you can actually get status on another, let's say, a European carrier. For example, Aegean, which is a Greek airline, they will give you the first level of status, which is the silver level, for only 4,000 miles for the year. 4,000 miles. This is one trip. And that will then give you free bags on United, Continental, US Airways, and everybody in the Star Alliance.
Now, this is something that you have put in your book, Decoding Air Travel. You also teach seminars. I would think that you would have a lot of companies that are sending their employees on business trips learning your methods.
Well, I wish there have been more. There have been a few. I've had CEOs, I have had owners of companies, I've had travel agents come through, I've done private training with certain companies. Yes, I hope the word will get out. The book explains in detail the method I use. Potentially a company, a mid-sized company, could save at least hundreds of thousands of dollars a year if they really know what they're doing. Unfortunately, they use travel agencies, which in turn use those same automated systems that Orbit and Expedia use, and so companies have no idea how much money they're actually leaving on the table.
Nicholas Kralev's new book is called Decoding Air Travel, A Guide to Saving on Airfare and Flying in Luxury. He is a former correspondent for the Financial Times and the Washington Times, and he will be at Travel Bug Bookstore today at 5 in the afternoon. So you're basically going to be giving a kind of almost a little mini seminar, is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. That will be a free crash course on the book, and hopefully the people who will come at 5 o'clock at the Travel Bug will find it worthwhile.
Nicholas Kralev is also at Nicholas Kralev, that's spelled KRALEV.com. Thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.